Welcome. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're going to have a show dealing with spiritual perseverance, otherwise known as God's right arm. And for those of you who are left-handed, this is no slight. It's just a colloquialism that the right arm is usually the stronger arm in probably 1 out of 10 to 1 out of 20 people. Stronger in 19 out of 20 people. And the rationale of the, we'll say, title is that most of the issues of perseverance are the opposing of what would be considered to be force. And most force in the universe is existence where we exist right now, which is the physical dimension of time and space. So from our perspective, we live in a sea of forces, some of them pretty hostile to even our own existence. And perseverance could be, just literally, the ability to resist and pursue aspects of the physical reality when confronted with forces. But spiritual perseverance has a different meaning. So I'm going to coin that tonight in this first part of the show by describing it in the following way and defining it in the following way. Spiritual perseverance is not just the ability to keep in one's direction and move in a way which overcomes some element of force, but it also, it also has within its context the ability to determine what is the direction of spirit in one's pursuit, regardless of the forces. That's a little different, isn't it? So in other words, let's use an example. I'll use myself tonight. Let's say I would like to find out how well I'm, how good I am at maybe flying certain kinds of devices and airships or airplanes. And so I spend a good deal of time learning about that, maybe going through some courses on it, dealing with the regulatory agencies that restrict you from doing that, and getting the opportunity in terms of finances to even have the opportunity to find some way to actually do something. That's all well and good. There's nothing wrong with that. Most of that is of a personal nature. Maybe that's why they call perseverance. But it isn't the same as a spiritual perseverance because it doesn't involve the question of God's thought. My thought would be the ruling factor in the example I gave. Let's change the example. So let's say that I'm learning all these things that I just described, not because I would want to have some fondness for flying, you know, for feeling of flying, or the experience of it, or the achievement of it, but rather because the spiritual aspect of it is that in service to others, I could use this skill and ability, we'll call it technique, to help people, serve people in some way which serves them to serve others more, which would be worth to serve. That then changes the formula, and it no longer has the stigma, I'll call it, of a personal nature, and rather becomes a soul nature. Even though at the beginning of each, there may seem to be almost the same things going on. In other words, my behaviors may, at least initially, look identical in either way. But in the long run, my behaviors would be spiritual perseverance, it is oftentimes a revelation, sometimes to the person who's doing the spiritual perseverance, but oftentimes to others, of what the person is actually doing. And in a non-spiritual context, there is virtually no spiritual component, and therefore, right from the get-go, someone could pretty well estimate what was the motive and what the likely outcome would be. You see, there are very different both motives and outcomes, and these are the factors that play so strongly to what I'm going to be discussing for the rest of the evening. And it's something that's so critical because, in reality, there is a heck of a lot that most people do not know about those who have spiritual perseverance. They literally may be in opposition to, or in some cases, literally trying to destroy those who have spiritual perseverance because they don't get it. They think wrongly there is a seeked outcome which is based either more on what they think of in a personal sense as perseverance, or even in a derogatory way. They think that there's some really nefarious, horrible thing a person is doing because in those situations, because there is spiritual perseverance, the person does things that are illogical and contradictory to the general thought that controls what people believe is motive. So you get a confusion, oftentimes in the antithesis, of what people's motives are when they're spiritually persevering. And this is more often than not. So it's a common experience. Even though spiritual perseverance isn't that common, it's common within spiritual perseverance that the motives of the people who are doing so are confused and sometimes literally reversed from what would be good into some evil or dark motive. This is unfortunate, to say the least, because it means that someone who is spiritually persevering has not only the forces they start with as an obstacle, but the additional forces of others with the misunderstanding, we'll call it, and sometimes evil that has the understanding but just wants to get those with this understanding to follow it, to oppose and destroy those with spiritual perseverance. Not necessarily because they're spiritual, but because the motive is misunderstood because it's so hidden, and by the time it's revealed, could be years, even decades later. This is a major problem when we're talking about trying to lead a spiritual life, because people who lead spiritual lives usually do a number of things that are spiritual, spiritually persevering certain elements of whatever their life is about. This is a big problem. Then how come it's God's right on? Because of the following reason. This is everything I teach, of course, if it's correct, God already figured out a long time ago, right? I mean, I'm just the pipe talking, you know. I didn't create it. And so here's the interesting part about this. This is actually a tool. I know this sounds crazy, but I'll go ahead and explain it. This is actually a tool to help prepare humans for leaving humanity and becoming superhuman. Not any longer having the, we'll call it, the separation of sense, which, by the way, is a major factor of progress in humanity, and of humanity, and not having the illusion of thought and of, we'll call it, the joining of thought between different bodies that many humans, most humans actually have. When you have those things, they disable most of the better things that people could be doing as souls while they're physically alive, and much of the time I don't even ask for it. So this is the problem. And the reason that God's right arm, the spiritual perseverance, isn't because people are spiritually persevering, but because it gets them to become targets and to be to have forces directed at them that they would normally either avoid or not even be noticed of. This is strange as all get out, because the reward for spiritual perseverance, by what I just described, in part, is an increase in forces and targeting by people who are dark and especially evil to eliminate and destroy anything that has even the slightest tinge of spiritual perseverance in it. Ooh. And you thought tonight was going to be pretty simple to understand, right? Okay, yeah, it is simple in some respects, because there needs to be, within the logic of the system, some way to get people off of the benches and to get in and really, roll up their sleeves and work like heck to do something that is highly difficult and spiritual at the same time, and to do so at what would normally be considered a considerable cost in the physical realm. The payment is almost always suffering to some extent, pain with the suffering, and also, we'll call it the discrediting and there's all kinds of negative things I can think of, but it's the misaligned nature of the majority of people that they meet, and then the unfortunate attention they get from being spiritually persevering from really dark and evil people that eventually leads to all of these terrible kinds of consequences. And they tend to be more focused towards the beginning of spiritual persevering. Wow. Because when someone gets really good at spiritually persevering, they sometimes are able to finally unify a lot of their sense, which allows them to overcome the threats and the other terrible things that evil does, and to eventually shine so much light out towards others that even the most lamest of thinkers in sensing people find that they notice that this person or that person is not evil, but is actually doing spiritual things that are good on God's side. But it takes some time, and that's the same place for sure.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Well, yes, we had another hiccup. The line we were on had some problems, and so they switched me to a different line. And that's why they ran commercials, because they were trying to figure out how to do all this. I hope I'm sounding okay to all of you out there. This is an experiment in live radio at 1,000 miles away. So we're doing it, and we'll see if it works. Now, getting back to the Spiritual Perseverance show, and we already ran our commercials, at least the ones we normally would do after 40 minutes or so. I'm going to just keep going and hope that we can stay on. Okay. So let's look at what's happening here. We've got an unusual situation because people who spiritually persevere, unlike people who personally persevere, are misaligned and are seen oftentimes wrongly as having wrong motive, and they're seen wrongly as being either dark or evil or just bad people or doing something selfish in some way. And they're doing something the exact opposite. And they many times find that they are the targets of some sort of dark stuff going on, as well as getting virtually no credit for anything that they do that is helpful, at least for a considerable period of time. That would be in years at a minimum. So someone does something that vows 6 months or a year of their life, they persevere, they do an amazing thing, and there's no recognition for it. And you can say, well, that's a bummer. No, remember, this is the test of God. The right arm of God is on your shoulder. It's not an easy thing. Because the object is to not desire to have credit, to not seek recognition, but to do these things for truly spiritual reasons. So the payoff is sometimes ugly, at least for a while, and when it does come through, it doesn't matter, because that person usually has gotten beyond needing or wanting any recognition for it anyway. Wow, this is so hard, because I know that it's against all the human nature kind of stuff that people oftentimes tell me is why they get up every morning. It's a real problem. And it certainly is not going to be, tonight's show will not be some kind of false motivation for folks, because it may be the exact opposite. It may discourage some people. But I think the point is that this needs to be talked about, because I know some folks this is happening to, and they don't sometimes understand what is happening to them. I've written about this. I've, of course, taught this before. But until you're caught in it, it's pretty much darned almost impossible to accept or realize or anything, because it's so unusual. It just is not the way the world usually works. It's like the atypical part of everything. Okay. So, God works in mysterious ways. Well, not so much if you're listening to this show, because we're here to demystify things. But, yes, in times past, I would say this was one of the great mysteries, and hard to explain in the context of the way that ageless wisdom in the past has been taught, because it is at least semi-mystical in most realms, in most places where it's taught. And this then becomes very difficult to explain because the forces thing aren't too well understood. And there's just a lot of stuff that's not well understood when it's mostly or somewhat mystical. People say, well, I don't get it. It's, well, you know, I hear what you're saying, but it doesn't make any sense. I'm trying to make this make sense tonight, even if you don't like it, because there is a rationale, and it's not that, you know, God's like some kind of sadist who gets off on making everybody feel horrible and torturing the heck out of them. Absolutely not. What is the real result of the torture and the pain and the problems are the still less than perfected conditions within the person themselves that is trying to spiritually persevere. That is the reality of the situation. And if you follow the science of it, it makes every bit of sense. But on a more common sense level, and based upon the way the rest of the world seems to be functioning, it doesn't follow. So we have to kind of move away from what would be considered the common variety of doing things with perseverance. And then recognize when spiritual perseverance is employed, expectations have to radically modify. So that doesn't mean that you have to somehow become some kind of monk or nun or something. No, it's the almost the opposite. You don't hide behind any kind of cloak and say, well, this is what I am and I'm making this sacrifice. There are numerous sacrifices in spiritual perseverance, and we'll talk about some of those in a little bit. But it isn't the sacrifice that is so commonly held that it is in some way a dogma about how one lives their life in style, or rather how one observes certain parts of life and ignores others. I don't think that it's any of those things, actually. Those things are the mysteries that have been created, and somewhat the dogma created by various religions, too, to hide the truth. And the truth is that spiritual perseverance is the result of how God set up the universe so that those that are struggling to become greater do so for the right motive and do so in the face of others seeing wrong motive, which is the greatest of tests, so to speak, for doing things with right motive. This is a toughie. Now, what happens when you do use wrong motive? Well, I'll tell you, it's almost impossible until you're a member of the next kingdom, when your senses are all unified in each body, and the three bodies minimal that are considered human are unified as well. And the person doing this unification thinks most of the time in spiritual thinking, that is fun. But when you don't have that going on, which is like the rest of us, right, then you have this unusual clumsiness in motive. I mean unusual in the sense that most people have clear motive. It's generally not very good, okay? Most people are plain selfish, and their motives are, if anything, bifurcated between 5% being unselfish and 90% being extremely selfish, and 5% it sometimes floats in between. That's kind of like the kind of motive most people have about almost everything they do in their life, and those are the good folks. They're not the dark, evil dudes. They're not the bad people. They are the good people, but they're still people. All right. Well, then, what about those few who say, okay, I'm going for the whole thing. I'll try to be good motive all the time. Yeah, good luck with that. What happens is the following. Most people with that ideation are usually either in two stages. Sometimes they want to be spiritually disciplining themselves. These wannabes are people who think about, read about, sometimes see others doing it, and say, gee, that'd be something neat. I would love to do that. And they sometimes represent others that they even are doing it. Okay, we'll get to that part too. That's certainly not spiritual perseverance. It's spiritual hogwash, but it's part of what happens. Okay, but eventually some of those folks and others besides them come to the conclusion that they're really going to try and do some spiritual motivating of themselves. And so they focus on trying to be of service to various people at times. And they do it. They actually try to spiritually serve. Serve spiritually means that they're doing what's in the best interest for the good of others, to help them to do more good. Not to help them feel good, not to help them think good, but to help them do more good. So they get involved with that, but then almost immediately things come up. Like, okay, I'll follow spiritual motivation and I'll serve those that need my service. Either I will co-serve with those who are more spiritually disciplined, or I will help serve those that are less so or equal to, and in either case, I'm willing to do that. That's a great thing. All right, let's see, you got that going for you. Where's the rub? Well, the rub is that when the time comes to actually do it, people flake out. They just, oh, well, I didn't know that I was going to have to do this and do it now. You know, I've got something else I'd rather do, or this is a little hard for me, or, you know, this is really, it's very uncomfortable, and really there's, you know, it's going to cost me some time or money, and I really don't have the energy, and, you know, I'm not feeling too well today. These are the things that start coming up. That's the beginning, but that's not the end. Then it gets worse. Okay, those are the beginning things. Oh, you've got to go through all that to get to the real motives. Okay, you have the small things. Those are the beginning things. What happens when you get through them? You say, okay, I'm still showing up. Yeah, I'm tired. I'm going to still do it. Yeah, I'm going to start putting in the effort without being asked to do it. Oh, boy, that's a biggie, right? Then the more stringent elements of the motive come into play. What is the cost to me versus the benefits to others? That's a selfish motive. Oh. Well, what if I'm doing something for somebody who really may not appreciate it? I don't know if they're going to. Why should I do anything until I know better? And know for sure they're really going to appreciate it. Yeah, guess what? That's selfish. And that motive leads to a whole bunch of other problems in people who want to spiritually serve. They become conditional servers. Condition means not that you're serving others to become souls, but you're serving others to do things that you think are good. But you'll be the judge of that. Oh, detect some egotism, and how about some self-interest in terms of your emotional feelings, which you wouldn't exactly call love, and it will be conditional love of a significant nature, if it is. And so this is where the battles start happening. This is the more sinister elements, I'll call them, of motives start to come out, and they are just vicious. They are everywhere. Well, do I have to serve with someone who doesn't believe everything I believe? What if they believe something different from what I believe? Yeah. Okay. And believe me, that happens right off almost immediately. That people show up from where or whatever, it doesn't matter, but they show up, and now you got to serve with them, but they don't think everything you think. They think somewhat differently. They aren't as nice as you are. You think. Oh, God. They want something from you. Oh. What about when they want to destroy you? What about when they want to hurt you? What about when they could care less about you? All of those conditions require spiritual motivation that is persevering in the face of incredible conflicts. Because it's pretty hard to serve people who really dislike you and want to destroy you. But some people are in that boat. That's a steep, difficult one to be in, because the general rule of thumb is, that's called a savior, that if you are there to save people, you must do so at the cost of your own life and existence and everything it means, even the cost of your spiritual perseverance of a sort, because you may not exist anymore to continue to do so, and yet you're still there to save people. Doesn't mean that you're there to save someone who says, I'm not interested and I'm not going to be saved. No. Then you say, well, then my motive is to serve those who are, because those folks will accept the service I have to offer. See? But again, motive plays a huge role here. And God's right arm is right there to let us know that we aren't there ourselves, as the conflicts arise and the pressures are put on us. And they are one heck of a lot of pressures. It starts off with such meager things, like, oh, I'm tired, so I don't feel like doing that today. And it gets into these incredibly difficult realms that most people never even think about, because they're not doing spiritual persevering. Their life is, well, I'll do it once in a while, you know, if I feel like it, you know, maybe a full moon meditation next month, or show up for some kind of lecture or class, you know, well, that's a big deal. Show up for a class. Oh, that's a big one. You see, here is where the problem lies. It's about focus on our little self. The little self is the precious jewel of the personality. And as long as the little self is getting something out of the action, it's okay most of the time to persevere. But most of the time, that means you're not spiritually persevering, because the little self does not involve spiritual. It involves personal. In order to get to the spiritual perseverance, it has to be the higher self. You have to be doing it as and for souls. That's a toughie. All right, so how do you get from here to there? If this is such a big climb, how do you ever make it? How does anybody even get halfway there without, you know, being wiped out in some crazy way? And the answer really lies in spiritual perseverance is not done by just focusing straight forward and going after these things. Because when you do that, you get knocked down too hard, and sometimes it costs you your life. You have to learn how to weave back and forth and in and out between the selfish motivations and the motivations that are doing something that are of service. You may have a spiritual motivation, but it doesn't serve anybody. And that's when you immediately discard it and go on to the next. It's learning to give up those things that get you to your higher self. If you keep pursuing the things that don't serve others, that's a mistake. And I know people doing this right as I speak. And it's a huge mistake when they learn otherwise, they see, feel, think otherwise, yet they still go on. That's a biggie. Usually it involves family and friends. Oh, I've got to, because it's my son, my daughter, my wife, my neighbor, my friend. Those are all wrong motivations. But the problem is that for those who live in this world, it seems so right. How can you eliminate your children? After all, they're your kids, your flesh and blood, and all this other stuff. Well, you treat them as souls, and then you don't have to worry about it. But if you treat them as children, you got a big problem. Because they will respond to you as a parent, and the results can be that you're in a feedback loop. You continue to do these really crazy motivations that are ultimately higher self-destructive and lower self-selfish, and definitely connected to and controlled by the personality. It is a mess, and people that do this sort of stuff have many other issues. But again, they for sure are having their big trouble with spiritual perseverance. And so God created this wonderful system to let us know about all that. So once we start getting spiritually persevering, we have an automatic, we'll call it Geiger counter, that's going to go off and let us know that we are getting radioactive because we're getting more and more selfish and we're not doing what we really intend and even state as our intention to do. The results can be pretty devastating because oftentimes it seems on the surface like we're doing so much of the right thing. After all your friends and neighbors say you should be helping your friends and neighbors. And all your children and wife or husband are saying you should be helping them. Yeah. And I won't even get into what the government is telling you and what this particular organization or authority is saying over others. I mean, it goes on and on. Humans are amazingly influenced by these personal perseverances and the challenges to their soul. So God wants there to be a conflict here in the physical world, and to some extent, depending upon where you end up in the astral world, there as well. The conflict in the astral world is nowhere near as forceful as it is in the physical, and life is much longer in the astral world. Because of the forces in the physical world, you don't live long because it just takes its toll. Your senses diminish so rapidly that some people can notice from one day to the next the results. That's frightening. And so God is telling us. It's the message. Now, what about people who aren't leading a spiritual life? They're not really concerned about what I'm talking about, right? Yeah, but they're on the other side of the fence. They are causing the problems for the people who are. So maybe they should be listening to this show. At least stand back. Get away. Let people be good. Even if you're not going to be, at the minimum, try to do no harm, right? You know? Try to do something that is not going to destroy what good there is. And there isn't a huge amount. At least not on Earth at this time. All right, so we have an interesting explanation of one of the most difficult areas of metaphysics to understand. This area was hidden for a very good reason, and I'll try to explain that. I mean, we talked about mysticism a little bit earlier, but why? Why is there mysticism? Why is there partial mysticism? Because when there wasn't, there was misunderstandings about the things that weren't mystified, and the dark side managed to twitch people's minds in the wrong direction. So hiding it through mysticism allowed people to be who had the ability to do so to discover some truth in it. Otherwise, evil would completely destroy the truth because it was so good at twisting it into the opposite of what it would have been. And so mysticism was there to kind of protect from evil the truth of things. And it worked very well for thousands and thousands of years. That today, truth is coming back out, but at great cost, because evil is again twisting it. Sort of at the same time truth started to become really important, so did propaganda and evil start using things to twist the truth so that people who try to spiritually persevere will become, you know, like terrible enemies and be forced away and unrecognized and sometimes even destroyed. So the unfortunate problem is, okay, mysticism was originally, at least, an antidote, of the problem, and it worked for a while until human beings developed more and more ability to determine truth through the development of their mental bodies. And now, truth is preeminent in comparison with what used to be the need to hide truth. Mysticism is a means of hiding the truth. It allows people to feel goodness, but not to intellectually, in a mental sense, understand truth. So you get into a whole different realm. We don't rely as much on that anymore. We seek to mentally understand things that are true because we start with a concept and see if there are any contradictions to the concept and examples. If there are none, then we say the concept is true until there are examples that contradict it. That is a new way of determining truth relatively for humans. People go back thousands of years ago, most people did not use that way. Some did, but they were usually advanced, spiritually advanced people. Most people didn't. Today, it's become the general population that is attempting to do this. It's a whole different thing. Okay, so what used to work in terms of preserving God and the, what could be preserved in ageless wisdom, too, in the, we'll say, the winkings, so that it could be brought into the focus of people's lives if they chose to, now has to be done in a different way. It has to be done through the concept method of proving truth as proving the concept, which is meaning that you have to explain the whole concept, or people don't can't do that. And that's what I do. That's one of my jobs, you can say. And so the process is relatively new, like the last 100 to 200 years. It's really become very strong. Before that, was more in a select number of few people. And if you go back 1,000 years, it was rare. So things have changed. Good things have happened. But they are not without difficulty. The evil says, well, okay, now they're back to looking at the truth, see, and the truth in a mental sense, we'll just take over part of the mental world, and they only need the fifth subworld to do this, and we'll get people to believe that things that aren't true are true, and true things are false. And we'll do this through lies we create, and we'll pipe these lies in, in ways where masses of people get it all the time, and they become convinced by repetition, and the mental body loves repetition. And so a thing called propaganda was invented to produce a certain rhythm in false statements, and it was used in a whole bunch of different methods, in different ways. Over time, it literally, we call it brainwashing, changed the ability for people to see the truth. They actually, for years of time, were fooled by evil. And this has been going on for quite a bit of time now. Some people are extremely good at this. The ones who are the best at it, people usually have an unusual emotional attachment to, affectionate even, and have a almost total blind spot to the virtual consistent and virtually an avalanche of lies coming at them every day from the same people, but done with almost an incredible level of, we'll call it theater drama, and the ability to look and sound convincing. And again, the rhythm thing is part of this. Rhythm is a mental factor. It's not, the astral body doesn't respond as well to rhythm as to some, we'll say, changes in rhythm. It likes that. But the mental body prefers rhythm, and it sometimes believes that if something has good rhythm, it must be true. this is the young mental body that doesn't, it isn't in a well-developed human who may have had, you know, a lot more lifetimes to develop that body. And the lotus, which is part of the higher mental body, is not well-developed. Then the rhythm thing works pretty good. And those folks are easy to convince and to destroy most of their spiritual perseverance, and also to get them to help destroy the perseverance of others. Ooh, tough work. Those who do the most spiritual perseverance use the rhythm of their mental body to challenge concepts, not reversed, not to support concepts, but to challenge them. They look for the asynchronous, that's a big word, the asynchronous example that doesn't fit the concept, and they search for that whenever they're looking for truth. Few people do that, by the way. Most people like the rhythm, and they find 100 things that support the truth, and they're not going to go look for the asynchronous concept or asynchronous thought form and examples. They're going to always stick with the ones that do are synchronous, because they like that. It just all fits together for them. Problem is, it's not true. Yeah. It isn't truth. It just is rhythmic. I give you an example. I know some of you are saying, well, could you give me more? You're talking to these concepts. They're bugging me. All right. One of the things that has been persevered in recent, we'll say, time, the last 15 to 20 years, has been that global warming is a big problem, and the planet is in grave threat of global warming. And so people invented all kinds of reasons why there is global proof of global warming. Some of these reasons included, well, the poles are certainly melting, the ice at the poles, that's a sign that something's warmer there, right? And because of the Coriolis effect, the North Pole particularly gets a lot of the heat that would be normally evenly distributed around the equator especially. And so that even makes more sense, and that's where the most severe of ice is melting. Although there's certainly bad things going on at the South Pole, too. But at any rate, so that's one example, but there's all kinds of other examples. Glaciers all over the world are melting. The seas are rising at somewhat significant rates. And there's other things going on funny in the atmosphere. You know, the temperature is changing. You got exosphere, the higher elements of the atmosphere are getting strange. So all these things support global warming. One problem, though. The thing that is most critical to establish that there is global warming is that there is global warming, and not warming at the poles or warming in 3 or 4 countries or warming next to this particular country in the ocean or in the ocean itself. These kinds of things are maybe factors, but they don't prove it. But if you had, let's say you took 100 samples from parts of the world, and every place is getting warmer by X number of degrees per year, Fahrenheit, say, a degree or two of Fahrenheit, that would be a very serious example of global warming. But remember, just because the poles are getting warmer isn't global warming. It's specific area warming, which may be related eventually to some global warming, but it doesn't prove that. Well, you know, that didn't bother people who were on the global warming side because, well, you know, you still know it's getting warmer. You can tell. Can you? Really? Most trends take longer than most people have memory. That's a fact. You've got to keep records for a long time and a lot of other factors. What's really going on is we're in climate change. climate change is not necessarily global warming. And then another thing that's really strange is that global warming is always blamed on fossil fuels and contaminants in the atmosphere. But there are two factors. Some of these contaminants cause warming, but some cause, because of reflections of sunlight and things, cooling. So if you really compare the total factors, in many cases, in parts of the world, depending upon where we're talking about, it may actually cause the opposite. Instead of global warming, global cooling. Well, what does all that mean? Should we spend a tenth, a fifth, a quarter of the world's annual wealth to change the climate to some way that isn't based on truth, but on rhythm, propaganda, and the need by others to politically gain control through redistribution of wealth rather than through changing the climate to some really healthier condition? Because most of the global warming argument has to do with wealth redistribution and not with dealing with any of the real issues that can be proven to be true in the climate. So these are the kinds of things that we've got to examine. And there was an example. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm against people being energy efficient, as conservative as possible in any energy use. And I'm certainly in favor of every kind of means of producing energy, provided that it doesn't redistribute wealth in such a way as to lead to general poverty and the eventual destruction of the ability for civilizations, societies in this world, to really fix the big problems, which might even be global warming, which someday will rear their head and we'll be all broke and have no money and have no freedom. Okay, so the question becomes here, and that was a very strange example I picked, but it's a good one because there's a lot of controversy with it. And finally, about 3 or 4 years ago, some scientists starting in England got caught carrying on the myth. And as part of the global warming, we'll call it conspiracy of scientists, they all got together with these English guys, and they published some stuff that went to the United Nations, and suddenly everybody accepted what was completely false. And then it was discovered to be false because some people challenged it and came up with opposite results and further found fudging or changes in the original calculations. Well, it's a pretty serious problem. One of the good news is about trying to find truth is that if math is used properly, it can be a very good tool for helping in truth because math does work with rhythm, but it also has the ability to uncover where rhythm is substituting for truth. So you can use math in many different respects, and it can help. There are some problems with math because some parts of the truth go beyond the present state of mathematics. So the present state of mathematics proves this or that, but it's unable to deal with things like some parts, more obscure parts, but some parts of quantum physics, which just is inexplicable mathematically. You can't really come up with an answer that will prove anything, because even the use of math, though that exists today, in those areas produces terrible anomalies. That is the limitation of the human being and its ability to create mathematics. It isn't some invariable problem with the mental body itself. Although the mental body, in seeking truth, while it has an excellent capability of doing that, truth is not even close to the most important realm of thinking. There's a thing called heuristic structures. A guy named Bernard Lonergan wrote a great book on that. And heroism, which comes more from Buddhic thought and intuitional thought, some people call it insight, is a totally different kind of thinking because it doesn't split up thought. And you don't have like, oh, concepts and examples and see what the truth is. And so it allows people to spiritually persevere a lot more convincingly to themselves and eventually to others. Why is it so important to persevere convincingly to yourself? Well, because what happens in most cases where people are at the beginning of the spiritual perseverance process, they fail because they give up. Giving up is the opposite of perseverance, in case you haven't figured that out. And so they give up because there's so many people against them, friends, family, neighbors, whatever, teachers. And they also give up because it's so darn hard, and because nobody likes them, and because they are misaligned about almost everything they consider, and they seem to have wrong motive when they have right, to other people at least. And they suffer immensely, and they're punished for being good. That's why they give up. But they don't give up if they have enough of this, we'll call it, Buddhic thinking, because they can see beyond it. They can see God, even though God's right arm is on their shoulder and pushing down, they got it. They say, go ahead, I got it. That's just a test of my ability to persevere. I'm not going to give up. That's not a problem for me, because I see the other side. I can see the whole banana. I don't need a concept or two that I have to constantly go through and figure out if I'm doing the right thing. Instead, I got the bigger picture. I have thousands of concepts that all fit together as I need them, whenever I need them, to serve others. And that is a greater truth than truth itself, because it always works, and truth doesn't. Truth eventually fails. No matter how much truth seems right at the moment, and it does have many moments where it's right, eventually there's something, some contradiction, an example, to the truth, because there's a bigger truth out there. All mental truth eventually fails. Only the truth that we won't even call truth anymore, but we'll call it heuristic structure or insight or intuition, that goes beyond the truth of the mental world. It's a new kind of truth. It is literally the inside more than the outside of God's mind. It's being God that tells you the truth is there in the Buddhic plane. Whereas in the mental plane, you are looking from the outside in, trying to understand God's mind and see if it applies in a situation or that. In the Buddhic world, you are God's mind, okay? At least in part. And now it's no longer like, oh, gee, I'm going to have to figure this out. No, I'm going to create it out. I create it out by being God and creating with hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of concepts at one time. Bingo, bango, there it is. It's so fast, it's unbelievable. And I don't go from one concept to the next and see if that concept is true also. It's a very laborious process to do that. And that's what, quote-unquote, many scientists do today. It's one of the reasons science is pretty slow, because it doesn't make these quantum leaps as it can do, but it requires something that goes beyond monastic or mental thinking. Lots of people say, well, where did Einstein come up with these ideas? One word, intuition. That's how you do it. You don't. It's a creative process. It's sort of like, what if, and I'll do all these other new things, and then what would that bring? Oh, there we go. That isn't the way the mental body works, because it's outside of rhythm again. Rhythm tends to lead to mundanity, that this similar thing is connected to the next similar thing is connected to the next one. There's always these building blocks of connection. But if you're going to be true genius, there's no building blocks. You don't get to the theory of relativity by just saying, well, I'll take these four building blocks and come up with number five. You've got to take a huge leap in thought. And that's why people sometimes, when they study these great ideas, the really big ideas, the real ideas, they are seeing Buddhic thought for maybe the first time. And they're just overwhelmed by it. Thousands of concepts or more coming together to create something new. Never been thought of before. Something so outside of all reality that it's hard to believe. The speed of light has a stop sign, at least in the dimension where you exist. Whoa. It's pretty far out. How about that energy and mass are exchangeable? And they're exchangeable by using the relationship of time and space, which has to do with the speed of light, by the way. So you end up with what is known as C squared, right? Speed of light squared, as being a measure of time and space in relationship to energy and mass. Mass causes, or energy, causes time and space to curve. If it curves, then time becomes changed. Because to go from one place to another, as you curve space, changes when you're going to get there. Right? So these are the kinds of things that Einstein came up with, but it took a quantum leap, we'll call it. There had to be something beyond the truth of the mental world, because that part of existence didn't include his ideas. As a matter of fact, they didn't include almost anything like his ideas. They mostly included the opposite, such as you could keep going faster and faster indefinitely. Or time and space are fixed things that don't change in relationship to mass or energy. Wow. All right, so this is a whole other picture. People who spiritually persevere are able to start doing what is known as, at least in the beginning, and this is just the beginning, they can think intuitively infrequently and sometimes uncontrolled. Sometimes they control it a little bit, but they do it infrequently. And eventually, when someone is using spiritual perseverance for any significant amount of time, and that's related to their goals in terms of their motives, which again, other people see wrong, they then develop the ability to control the intuition. Now, what is controlled intuition? It means you come up with a creative idea. And the idea is huge. The idea is that time and space are part of each other, and energy or mass, either one, because they're completely convertible from one to the other, curves time and space. All right. Well, that changes everything, but all right. And then you start trying to understand all of the other elements of what that idea is. And suddenly you're rushed in with thousands and thousands of concepts. Just shoo. And you can start coming up with all kinds of amazing, amazing conclusions that other people are just dumbfounded by, including the speed of light is absolute in a dimensional sense. Wow. And the faster you go towards the speed of light, the less time it takes to get wherever you're going to. That's a whole other thing, isn't it? Because the space is changing in relationship to you, and as you change the space, you change the time. It's so incredibly amazing. and I'm using only that as an example because so many people are amazed by it. There, this goes on, believe it or not, all the time, but not too much in the human kingdom, because human beings have a great deal of trouble trying to use Buddhic or intuitional thought in any controlled way. Controlled means that you have a creative idea and you want to put it into existence. You want to create something beyond just the idea itself. And from that, now you need all of these wonderful concepts, and whatever you need, it just flows into you as what we'll call omniscience, or all knowledge that is present in the world that you exist in, within the dimension of time and space you can reach. So in this case, it's Earth's intuitional plane, and the beings there have omniscience. They're all connected together, and so all the thought of those beings and all the concepts that they have, that they contain, are available, just like they're your concepts, and vice versa, by the way. This is a tremendous change, because most human beings, again, test within their own minds a single concept, two examples, to try to determine truth. Now the truth is determined by the omniscience, all-knowingness, of thousands of beings, possibly, at least hundreds, and it's come flowing in. There are thousands of people on Earth who have some level of controlled intuition, but there are only a little over 100 that are actually out of the human kingdom at this time. Not too big of a number, is it? But still, it's a lot of thinking going on. Thousands of people total. A lot of thinking going on. And this allows people to become spiritually perseverant when the odds are so far against them. How much can someone create Buddhic thought? Well, I watched an experiment for a couple of years here, where I am at, and some people tried to do it using a thing we called synthetic yoga. Found out that it really works, a lot of drawbacks, because the amount of controlled intuition has to balance the amount of change in rhythm in the human brain, we'll call it, in the mental world as well as in the astral and physical. And if you don't balance these, if you're not disciplined enough to keep them in balance, they can cause heat in the mental brain, which eventually causes destruction in the lower brains as well, and can lead to really severe problems for people. So it isn't an innocuous type of spiritual discipline. It is rather one that has to be used with great care and usually without being too much into any kind of bad motivation. Remember, as I talked earlier, the wrong motivation is one of the biggest problems, and it's what stops people. But if you're using this powerful tool with wrong motivation, by the time you actually say, uh-oh, I'm doing the wrong thing, you may have caused some serious brain damage. That's what we found. Now you can see why we don't just every day say, well, here, try this yoga and see if it works for you. Because there are some serious problems with it. It's only for those who have significant levels of spiritual discipline. And its spiritual discipline needs to be at a minimum in the three lower bodies. The element of controlled intuition is so foreign to most people that most people have none. They have some uncontrolled intuition. And they heuristically put together some kinds of, we'll say, concepts from time to time. But they are unable to first decide what they want to create and then just have it available to them. That's the problem. So most people don't do that. And that's called, they only have, at times, uncontrolled intuition. No controlled. Controlled intuition requires a balancing of the thought processes in three parts of what is known as the lotus, between three different subplanes of the higher mental body. If you can't establish and maintain that rhythm there, the danger is you'll create heat in the lower mental body, which will lead to forgetfulness, loss of focus and concentration, and a sloppiness in thinking. Not because you're lazy, but because the mental body will be damaged from this whole misapplication of a spiritual discipline. These are the interesting elements of spiritual perseverance. When someone wants to really move ahead, they must do so methodically, using real spiritual discipline, not some kind of like, well, I'll pretend today like I'm really disciplined, and then tomorrow, of course, or tonight, I won't be. Nobody will know, though, because I'll do this or that in complete absence of other people. That's a recipe for disaster, when people do that all the time. You can't use these advanced methods then, because they are so powerful that the results could be devastating. And it is important, again, to recognize that these advanced methods work with God's right arm. They are there to augment, not to alleviate the pressure from the forces. They augment them, but they do so by changing what was a force before into a form of spiritual service. So these great forces that actually become much greater are also sequentially and almost in real time changed into from forces into service. So as that takes place, there's no more danger from the forces, and you don't develop the heat in the brains and the other problems, and people are healthy and well and serve. Those are good results. You do have to worry about the opposite, though, and that happens all the time. Okay. So, how can we improve, then, our spiritual perseverance if there's so many advanced issues that seem to prevent people from being able to do it in ways that are relatively simple or relatively easier? Well, the first thing is to recognize that mundane discipline, not spiritual discipline, needs to be done first. If you cannot discipline yourself in a mundane fashion, I don't care what it is that we're talking about, but if you can't do it, don't think that you're going to be able to spiritually persevere. You will not. As a matter of fact, you'll be a spiritual yo-yo at best. It is critical that people who, especially if they're not going to be hypocritical, people who want to lead a spiritual life first achieve good, if not extremely good, mundane discipline in all three of their lower bodies. Once those bodies have mundane discipline, and what is mundane discipline? What do I mean? I'll give you an example. Well, mundane discipline is maybe not eating sucrose because it screws up your mental apparatus and other parts of your body, including your teeth. Maybe it involves giving up the eating of meat, but you can eat maybe the product of animals. Different story. So you can drink milk, but you don't eat meat. That's a possibility. Maybe it means giving up not having affectations that allow you to escape the deficiencies in your lower self and personality. Those affectations might be tattoos or possibly certain kinds of dress that allows you to become an identity with other people rather than being a higher self. These kinds of things prevent people from being their higher self because they augment and accentuate a false lower self. And they allow people to develop eventually personality disorders without them being totally disabled by them, because they adjust their personality disorders by how many affectations they're using, and the identities with these affectations and with other people like that allows them to cover it up. But it also prevents spiritual life and certainly will interfere with spiritual perseverance. Interesting idea. Okay, so let's move then to what else can you do besides mundane disciplines. It becomes inherent and almost necessary these days, not so much before, because there was a thing where people, you know, could become, you know, great spiritual servers, and we would call them saints, and they would do just amazing things out of pure sacrifice. Those days are pretty well gone, because those people are gone. Today, most people are very fixed monastically, not astrally. And no matter how much they will it and love others and are willing to sacrifice any part in an emotive sense about their life, today people need to be very mentally fixed and find and help to create more truth in themselves and others. And that's a different kind of spiritual service. So people need to have better understandings, and that comes from study and from being able to learn about, but then apply the learning of spiritual, we'll call it information, and eventually of what a person decides to be spiritual truth. This includes reading, if it's an example for those people who are listening to this show, reading and understanding things that we'll call ageless wisdom. Ageless wisdom is not a religion. It's a way of understanding how the universe works, which includes God. It is far from a religion, because it doesn't tell you how to worship God. And it doesn't tell you how to get together with other people who are doing that. That's what religions do, right? But this is not a religion. This is a means of understanding or gaining consciousness. And it's very important to increase consciousness, and one of those ways is through education. But the education also helps to develop the mental mind and somewhat the Buddhic body. How does it do that? Because the concepts in ageless wisdom stimulates the mental body to unify, so that it just reading the concepts causes the mental body to unify. And it allows people to, therefore, think much faster and think with multiple concepts similar to Buddhic thought, but still not completely joined yet in real time with the examples of the concepts, because therefore it is still mental thought, but they're getting closer because there's so many multiple concepts they're using that they're joining multiple examples with, that it's getting closer and closer to Buddhic thinking. And that is the process. That process right there gets you much closer to becoming a controlled intuitive thinker, you see. And you can do this without synthetic yoga or some other more advanced method, which may be dangerous for a lot of people, unfortunately. Now, it doesn't mean you have to avoid every kind of danger. Some of them are worthwhile to try, provided you know and understand the situation well enough. Okay, so when people seek to spiritually persevere and they have these, we'll call it, inklings of how to use their mental mind in a more appropriate fashion, because they've read something or they listen to this show as an example, or a lot of these shows, then it helps them to start becoming a bit intuitive. First, it starts with uncontrolled intuition. The uncontrolled intuition is when there is enough spiritual perseverance, regardless of whether or not the person has really developed their Buddhic body in the past. So their Buddhic body may not be well developed, but there is so much spiritual perseverance that still connects to the Buddhic body. And the Buddhic body, all it needs is the connection, and it can be used. It's a weird thing, but the Buddhic body instantly responds to service. And if you are spiritually persevering enough and you're doing it for right motive, even though you haven't worked on all the spiritual disciplines to get the Buddhic body fully developed, it's right there to assist you, and that's called uncontrolled intuition. When it does, it's like magic. And you may not know how you did it. Where did that come from? I'm not sure. And again, this causes people to become suspicious. Did you cheat? Who told you about that? Where did you read about it before this? Are you plagiarizing somebody? You must be, because where did you come up with that from? You know, that sort of stuff. These statements are false accusations, but they come from people misunderstanding the motive and misunderstanding how it all works. But if you know it, you can persevere even in the face of conflict, because you can say, well, if I get into a jam, uncontrolled intuition is a possible savior for me until I can develop the controlled side. That may take a few more years, but I can live with this other thing in the meantime. And for a lot of folks, this is a good way to go about it. And it really works. Now, how do you know for sure it's uncontrolled intuition? Because you get flooded with concepts, and it's effortless. You're not doing nothing. Just flooded with concepts, and all of a sudden, it's like you're Einstein on steroids, and you got, boom, there it is, all the supporting ways and all of the examples that support those concepts, with all the possible contradictions being met by a bigger and bigger concept. So eventually there is this ultimate truth that goes beyond the mental world. And the ultimate truth is an idea. It's not a truth anymore. And that idea is so powerful, so amazing, that it will, instead of lasting for 50 years, as many truths may last, it will last 50,000 years, possibly. And it has a huge difference in its usefulness. But even Buddhic plain ideas don't last forever, because there's something even bigger. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So you're getting into this spiritual perseverance as a way to, we'll say, truncate the deficiencies in a person's both mental and Buddhic body, provided that their motive is clear enough to spiritually serve, and they're willing to sacrifice and do whatever it takes to achieve the results which they know in their heart and mind to be the right thing, even though they don't know it in a conceptual way, trying to figure it out in some slow fashion. But as soon as they're faced with the need and the problem and the service to others, all the concepts are right there for them to use. That's uncontrolled intuition. It should happen in most people sometimes. Some people don't have any of it, and sometimes other people have it happen more often than not. It really varies with the person. Spiritual perseverance, though, is a big, huge part of how often that takes place. Okay, let's say you've gotten past the uncontrolled part half the time. That means spiritual perseverance only has to carry you through the half that you're not so done on. But how does it apply then to the Buddhic body? Well, this is the funny thing about it. The Buddhic body is a wonderful body, but it's not the highest that a human being can reach, and it's not the highest that a master beyond a human being can have as a useful body, in a sense. Although the human being will not have sense beyond the Buddhic body, otherwise they wouldn't be human anymore. But they only have a very minor amount of sense in the Buddhic body. They can develop, this sounds a little hard to believe because they don't have any sense, Atmic, that's the next plane above the Buddhic plane, Atmic service. What the heck is Atmic service? Holy cow, we're just talking about Buddhic, which is controlled intuition, right? Which comes from a thing called omniscience, a sense of omniscience. Well, but the sense of omniscience is, you know, for most humans, is only controlled not even half the time. Most humans are not even close to that. What about this other thing, which is omnipotence, which is the ability to become all-powerful? How does someone become all-powerful? Well, and let's talk about those that don't have in a controlled manner. which is any human being. No human being can have controlled omnipotence. But you can have a fraction, a little bit of uncontrolled omnipotence. Now, what would that mean? What did that look like in a human being? Well, if your motive is extremely clear, there's no selfish motive, and that's got to be like 100% to get to the nirvana, which is the atomic place, 100% of pure good motive, regardless of what other people think of you. It doesn't matter. That's not really the whole issue. 100% clear good motive, 100% spiritual perseverance. What is 100% spiritual perseverance? There is no personal issues at stake. You do not care what the personal outcome is. It will not make any difference to you, no matter how it affects you personally, period. That's it. You got that going. And you have to have some level of controlled intuition, only a fractional amount, though, not anywhere near what a master would have. But some level of controlled intuition. A lot, possibly, of uncontrolled intuition, too. And then it is possible to become omnipotent about some things. All-powerful about some things. Oh, this sounds crazy. Right? What human being is all-powerful? Well, let me explain. All right. So if you have all of the combination of things that I just said, okay, then you can literally change the minds, the hearts, and the behaviors of a person or any number, including a whole population, a whole country, maybe even parts of the world, maybe the whole world, in a very short period of time. That is getting to become omniscience, especially when it's worldwide. It eventually becomes worldwide, then it's really, you really start talking about something on omniscience. Well, who's ever done that? Actually, there are a number of people who have done that. One of them's in the hospital right now. I don't know if he's going to make it through this weekend, but Nelson Mandela did that. And how did he do it? Well, he spiritually disciplined himself. I know he's into redistribution. You don't have to tell me that. You know, I know that because communist people helped him, and he has some feelings about that. That's not the issue. The point is he changed an entire country, which affected the entire world, and he's close to becoming a member of the next kingdom. So what he was able to do is he spiritually persevered for 30-some-odd years in captivity and other terrible conditions. The loss to his personal self was incredible. It was virtually 100%. The only thing he didn't lose was his physical life, which almost he did then. Wow. And from that, you end up with an amazing change in the world. What is that change? Well, the most prejudicial country as far as race is concerned, at the time, South Africa became mostly a non-prejudicial country in a matter of a few years. I mean, a pretty amazing thing. And he became the president for a while of that country. Now, does that mean that he changed everything? No. He changed some things that were impossible, seemingly impossible, to change because he became all-powerful. The power he exhibited was purely spiritual perseverance. It had nothing to do with him lifting up his hand and smiting his enemies or any of that kind of stuff. It had to do with everybody seeing that the things he was standing for were soul things that were right for everybody. Even the evil ones, even the dark ones, said, well, that Nelson guy, he's got it going. Sure, some of them hated him in the beginning of the process, but at the end, that was not true. And it isn't based upon everybody thinking he's wonderful. It's just that he controls the situation to the point where the things that matter to him in terms of spirit or God helping others to experience God becomes a reality, and he did that. He actually did that. Oh, what about the corruption of today there? What about all the other problems? What about some of his disciples, students, failing? Well, all that happened. Again, because you're omnipotent in a certain point in time and space, does that mean that you are God and you have changed the whole universe forever? Just the opposite. God would never do that. God says, let each learn to be part of me. And Nelson came very close to doing that, didn't he? I mean, he actually exhibited godlike qualities without himself being affected by it. Humility was of the greatest level in all that he did. Such a wonderful thing to consider. Who else? Well, we think of another fellow, Gandhi. Gandhi was nowhere near the level of initiate that that Nelson Mandela was. But he did reach, in Indian terms, nirvana. He was capable of producing some all-powerful effects. Well, somebody shot him, didn't they? Well, they shot him when he wasn't all-powerful. That's right. But while he was all-powerful, he changed India and the world. He freed India from the rule of a formidable power, England, and he attempted to unify the people of England. But the problem is that the religion of Islam, unto itself, doesn't want to be part of any or connected to any other religion or any other political system that allows any other religion. And this produced the unfortunate splitting of the country into Pakistan, you know, and et cetera. It's more just Pakistan, a little pieces here and there. But the thing that both mostly understand here is that India was a captive of another country and had been a colony and was a profitable one at that. Everybody says, well, England was in bad shape after World War II, and they're just like, oh. Not really. They would have just liked to have had a nice colony to help support them back to health again. The loss of India was a severe blow to their economy. But the important thing to realize is that people recognized that Gandhi was right about so many things in terms of what he was saying was spiritual perseverance. He recognized that if people spiritually persevered, they would eventually win, even when others were using violence against them, even when others killed them sometimes, when he died in that vein, but not during the specific time that he was in the service. Did he have controlled intuition? Yes, he did. Did he have uncontrolled intuition? Yes, at times he had that too. Why wasn't he an advanced initiate like Nelson Mandela? Because Gandhi was still finishing his astral disciplines and was only working in part on his mental disciplines, whereas Nelson Mandela is working on his Buddhist disciplines. So a very different kind of spiritual disciple, but each contributed with their abilities within their level of discipline towards spiritual perseverance, and they succeeded. Now, I don't expect everybody who's listening to me is going to go out and become Gandhi, you know, the great Mahatma, or Nelson Mandela. I instead would say each of us is going to be something special and creative and different from all others. There is only one of those in each case. There's only one of us in each case. We all eventually have the opportunity to become, through the spiritual perseverance, what any of these great beings that we have known about has been. We can do the same things, but not in the same ways. we can achieve these grand abilities within ourselves. All right, what is the we'll call it the single most important element to spiritual perseverance? It's combining the ability to sacrifice from the first rite, and that joined with some element of purpose from the first rite. Those are the first parts of God, first part of God's mind, with the love for others from the second rite, and the ability to be unusually inclusive, seeing that there is a oneness in certain ways that other people aren't recognizing, joined together, that leads to spiritual perseverance. It is the key nature that it means that you're developing something new in a spiritual sense here on earth. Every person who is spiritually perseverant and is doing so at their level of response, the level of their senses are unified, does so in a unique and new way of being spiritual. There are no copycat spiritually perseverant people. Not a single one. This is so hard to imagine because human beings love to be copycats. It's so much easier. I'll just read what someone else will do, and then I'll do it myself, and I'll be somewhat great like they were. Maybe not as great, but I'll be somewhat great, which is cool. Yeah. No, that's not spiritual perseverance. You have to, the path that each person does is their own, which is why it's such a treacherous path, why it's so difficult to do, because you're forging it yourself. There are no textbook answers for spiritual perseverance. I know there are for personal perseverance. There really are. But there are none for spiritual. It's almost the antithesis of this very idea. And so, from that standpoint, I can't give you formulas that are specific, because that would be a contradiction to what I just taught. And the issue for a lot of people is overcoming that problem. The fear for many people is of true creation, because true creation means you can fail terribly. And that could lead to terrible suffering and pain, to terrible losses of almost anything and everything a person can consider important. And that's the fear of all of that. And eventually the fear of death is probably the biggest. But these are overcome when people spiritually persevere, because they love the creation and they create new love towards and with others. Those two come together, as I explained, and produce a new kind of spirit or spiritual life. So each person pursuing a spiritually, we'll say, persevered mortality, and particularly if they're doing so at near their ability levels, are doing so in the most creative and different way from everyone else. And they may be in a genre that's similar to some people, but the uniqueness of their methodologies are just what I said, unique. So the real critical part of God's push in this is to bring human beings who are self-selecting to do this into a greater state of spiritual creativity, and to bring unique gifts of spirit into their world, and in this case, Earth. Those that actually achieve this are amazingly revered, but usually centuries later. Sometimes it's just decades, but seldom less than that. Isn't that frightening? That it takes so long, because so much negative hostility is pushed on them, so much wrong motive is placed on them, and so much direct physical confrontation is oftentimes invoked, or evoked, I should say, towards them. And as well, there could be significant amounts of material wealth used against them and taken from them. So all that is going on while these poor spiritually developed people or developing people are trying their best to persevere, and the forces are just going out of sight. That is what this is about, though. If you understand tonight's show, you can fare the weather much better. Your likelihood of success, I think, goes up significantly just by understanding tonight's show. Now, is this for everybody? No. I think most of the listeners, this will just be an area of like, well, I'll put that in the book, and maybe five lifetimes from now, I'll pick it up again. But you see, it's also an answer to those who are doing it because they need it desperately. And it's an encouragement to those who have the book maybe for a few lifetimes lying around that they haven't picked up. And they say, you know what? This makes sense. Now that I understand it better, I think I can handle it. I'm going down this road. The more people we have to go down this road, and that do it somewhat successfully, the greater the chance that Earth will get out of its present disastrous circumstances and the evil that is growing leaps and bounds around us. The lies, the incredible destruction of people's personal sanctities in existence. And it's happening everywhere. It's not just any particular country. It's happening throughout the world. Those things need to be confronted, and only the spiritually persevering people will do so. Don't expect it from the President of the United States. I mean, he's on the other side of the fence virtually entirely. Nor should you expect it from anyone who has personal agendas, whatever they may be. I don't care if it's for power or money, control of this or that. Those agendas are treacherous, and they prove time and again that that person is not a spiritual person. Okay, so this is an encouragement for those who may be on the sidelines, and it is also a prescription for those who are involved but really didn't have a clue what's going on, but they know it's not good, and can somebody please explain why? And if you really are having problems with this and you still don't get it, call me. Or you can email me and then we'll arrange a phone call. But the point is that you could do either. You can call or it doesn't matter. Just try to contact me because I can help. I can help because I know it firsthand. I can help because I understand it and I teach it. And I can help because there is a whole array of ways to work out problems. I'm not going to help by being the creator. That's the job of each individual. Remember, this is a very individualistic endeavor. I can help because I can teach. And there's much to learn about this area that is so incredibly, we'll say, fulfilling and meaningful, but terribly difficult even understand, much less get through. Now, some people are going to undoubtedly doubt that what I'm saying is true. That's okay. You know, one of the things about this show is to get people to think, so it's a big thing, and so this is an area where you can try to think it through and see if I'm out of my mind and half of what I said is probably lunacy or whatever. Go ahead and check it out, because it is through checking it out that you will become able to determine on your own whether there is truth there or not. I don't think you even need me for that. But if you do come to the conclusion that some of what I'm saying has some validity, then it is important to possibly get some help, because, believe me, this is not an area that is one you want to be over your head in, because remember, the other side, the dark side, wants people who are spiritually persevering to give up. That's how they win. Just say, oh, well, I think I'll take a year or two off. I heard that the Bahamas are a very nice place to visit. Well, maybe I can go do this in some other place and let somebody else make the decisions for me. Maybe I can join some sect or religion that will kind of help buffer the problem. There's lots of dodges. There's lots of ways to escape from the serious problems that come from spiritual perseverance. But there is no substitute for it in reaching much higher levels of consciousness and eventually the greatest service you can be, which is your soul. Souls spiritually persevere as a matter of nature, not as a matter of discipline. Now, what do I mean by that? Because that confuses people. I've said it before, and it has confused people before. Souls by nature don't have selfish lower selves. They don't even have personalities. They help to create them so we can exist in these lower realms, but they don't live here with us. So they don't need them and wouldn't want them. They, by nature, their very existence, the way they're made, do not even have a selfish part to them. They don't know what that is. That's the reason when we die, the selfish part of our life never becomes fully recognized by the soul. Some people don't know that. I explain that in the textbook I wrote. But it's hard to believe that. Why would such a great being not want to know what it helped to create, how it screwed up everything? And the reason is because they don't have a sense of it, and it wouldn't help them to experience it. What helps them is to know how to create around it and to improve us. And the strange part about it is this is a partnership. We spiritually persevere in at least the three lower worlds, including the lower mental world, so that it complements the soul's creative side of helping to develop new personality for the future and work out the conflicts from the old one by determining what spiritual genes to use, which affects our karma, without having to actually have the experiences of selfishness that personality created in a prior lifetime, or any personality did. They don't have to have the experience. All they need is to see and experience the holes in us, to find out how to build a, we'll call it, more interactively healthy and serving personality. Not so easy to do, by the way. Very difficult. But this is the challenge they have. Now, we can do some of that even while we're physically alive and, of course, while we're astrally and lower mentally. To really reach that point, by the way, to get to the level where you function as a soul, you still have to have the spiritual perseverance at the same time. Remember, the soul doesn't need that. It is by nature already that. So here we're going through the struggle of spiritually persevering while we're trying to become our soul who is thinking of future creative possibilities of solving problems for other souls that are in and around and incarnate most of the time with us. That's a big deal. If you see the people around you as souls that are potential souls who are having great problems because they aren't spiritually persevering as people and because they can't understand, much less being conscious, their soul, as well as they can't maybe understand God pretty well, the process then becomes really focused on those that are spiritually persevering, because they got both sides of the coin at the same time. This is good, but it is very difficult, because it means that while you're working and trying to be a soul, you also have to be spiritually persevering in many ways in which you have to sacrifice based upon purposes that are unclear to you and sometimes even strange to you, while others are doing everything they can to harm you or stop you or demean you or whatever, while at the same time, you're developing the senses that the soul uses, which are unified within the three bodies and brought back to the soul level of higher mental and Buddhic realm. And at the same time, you're starting to see and understand others around you as lost souls, souls that aren't coming through their personality-driven, lower self-driven, selfish life. This is the secret towards this whole plan, and it's very difficult to experience it and hold it always as it needs to be together. Sometimes you have it, sometimes you lose it. If you lose it, you go back and work on getting it back. It's a difficult thing because it's extremely hard for humans to do what we're talking about. But it is possible. And tonight's show, I hope you're finding this to be true. Tonight's show was meant to be a kind of how to be spiritually perseverant, at the same time recognizing all of the other elements that are at play in this process. I find it intriguing. I hope you do too. Let's go to the soul factor now. The soul factor is that we are trying to be souls here, right? And trying to be a soul here isn't just a question of spiritual perseverance, because souls don't need that. It's a question of attempting to recognize that there are every human around us, almost every human, is connected to a soul as well. And that soul has a plan. We need to work with that soul's plan. It may be the antithesis of what the person wants. It may be the antithesis of who they are and what they are. And that's our problem. And when that takes place, that's when the spiritual perseverance comes in. That's when you have to have it. So, you've got to do everything you can, but it may not be to the other person's liking. It may be against their liking. It may not be what they think that they want from you, quite the opposite, and it may be that they'll fight you every inch of the way because that they want to be a person and not a soul, and you're trying to help them to be a soul and not a person, or at least not a selfish person. So you see, this is the tremendous pressure that people can put themselves in just by being spiritually perseverant. But incredibly, the process leads to miraculous improvements and change. It can actually produce in a relatively short time, I'm talking about years or so, a new kind of, we'll call it, partnership. Remember, the soul doesn't need spiritual perseverance, but we do. So we formulate in us both sides of who we are. We say we're human, and we have to be spiritually perseverant because here there are tremendous forces that will block us. The soul doesn't have that. The soul in its own realm doesn't exist that way. But we're also a soul. That could be a soul here, provided we serve others as souls, recognizing they have a soul. And what does that soul want from us? Not what they personally want from us, which will oftentimes be the antithesis of what we're offering. But we do that, and we bring the two together, and we spiritually persevere with that motive. Now we're coming back to the beginning of the show. Because, as I said, people don't have a clue of what your motive is. But now you can see why they don't. Because you are working, or we that are spiritually persevering, are working for something they don't even know about. It's their soul. And their soul wants something that's against what they personally and lower self-wise want. And so, since we're working against their personal motives and personal interests and selfish motives at that, but in favor of their soul's motives, they see us as the enemy. They see us as having wrong, bad motives. We've got to be the bad ones. And they become open to being used by evil, because evil says, good, if you think these good people are bad, we'll convince you they are. We'll help you every way we can. We'll come up with new and great ideas of why you can discredit them and why you can do terrible things to them and how you can get away with this. We'll help you in every which way because we want to destroy the good. And so they become open to possession, open to all of the vagaries of being a wasp from their own soul, and they come after us. Now you see why I said what I said at the beginning of the show. This is the problem. And you can't get out of it by saying, okay, well, I'll solve the problem. People will like me, provided I don't serve their souls. I'll just be spiritually perseverant about nothing. That's right. Because if you get rid of the other side of the equation, there's nothing you can persevere that will mean anything. Because spiritual means soul. It means you're going to persevere being God in form. The spirit is here to become part of form, God in form. And it's only going to do that if you choose it, if we all choose it. Uh-huh. I hope this is coming together. All right, so then how do we get around those people, and there's huge numbers of them, that want to fight because we're trying to serve their souls, and they say, no, I don't want you to serve my soul. What do you got for me? What's in it for me? Me, myself, my lower self, and I. And there is an answer, and I've got just about 30 minutes here to try to explain it to you. All right. So how do you fix this problem without allowing these folks to eventually destroy us, because that's what they're going to eventually try to do. They may not succeed, but they will try to do that. Well, there's two things that could happen. The first is the following. It's kind of very interesting. If you are really diligent in your spiritual perseverance, and if you are very good in your motive, clear motive, you can reach as high as the Atmic plane or the plane where you become omnipotent. Once you reach a level of omnipotence, you become all-powerful to those who are the opposite and who are doing what I suggested they will do, which is to fight for their personal and selfish motives. You're able to defeat those motives before they can do any serious or significant harm to you or others that you're co-serving with by being omnipotent. And there's so many infinite number of ways to do it because it's all a creative process and it's done at the moment and during that interaction or interactions that are going on. It sounds impossible. I know, I'll just become omnipotent. Sure, that's going to solve. That's how you do it. That's one way. That's one possible way. What's the other possible ways? Well, you also can do it somewhat from what I'm doing right now. If you reach a high enough level of controlled intuition, you can teach. And in your teaching, you will gain others' attention who will join in and be somewhat helpful in, again, defeating the evil. But not through omnipotence, rather through consciousness and through a revelation to the general, we'll say, public of the evil that is being done by those that are being controlled by the dark side and those who willingly go down that path. They may not be evil themselves, but they're willingly going to go down the path. So you have potentially a whole army of people that could be of somewhat help. And this is different than just being omnipotent, because that's a more singular position. This is working with many others to achieve a similar goal, but through a very different kind of process. One that's slower, but nonetheless effective. So we shouldn't condemn it just because it's slower. It's just that it may not be to all of the things that we would like to have happen, because the timing may cause us to suffer some in between, whereas if you can just do it instantly, you don't have that time problem, you know, where, oh, gee, it's going to take me another year or two, you know. That's a long time, but it isn't really that long. These things can be achieved even within the time that we have, which sometimes is shorter than we would like it to be. What else can you do? Well, those two things are formidable, but they are not by any means the entire, we'll say, quiver that you can draw from. If you have the clear enough motive and you're willing, so to speak, to become more publicly noticed, it is possible to counter some of the untruth through visible means in various ways. Doing something that is highly public, but also reveals the bad motives of those around you and the more correct motives of yourself without promoting the motive itself. The motive comes through, the right motive comes through, by the effects of serving others in real time. But you have to make yourself publicly noticed in various ways. Sometimes the public notice may be very infamous to begin with, but just you have to be able to turn it around by showing enough right motive and enough spiritual perseverance that people do take notice. Remember, the spiritual perseverant person becomes a soul-like being who is noticed by others over time. Yes, in the beginning, you may be nobody who is never noticed by anyone. But that's a whole other story, because that may only serve to bolster up your eventual other abilities. And within a few years, you may be doing some of these incredible things I'm talking about. But you have to have the tolerance for the few years, at least, because that's nothing in terms of spiritual time. What else can you do? Well, there's an interesting point about this. This hasn't been done to my knowledge, but I think it's worthwhile considering. There's a whole bastion of people who are spiritually perseverant. Now, they are not large in numbers like, you know, most other groups of people might be, but they are significant, certainly in the hundreds of thousands of people. So that being the case, with the present advent of the Internet, etc., it may be possible to reach out to those folks. Now, I know what I said earlier, each is doing their own individual perseverance thing, but they are all working as to bring out soul qualities in themselves and in everybody else they're serving. So they have a common denominator. The main thing here is that part of their common denominator is to serve other servers. So you're a soul, and you have spiritual perseverance, which is unique, but you're a soul, which is the common denominator with others. And those others that you contact and let them know who you are appreciate and love who you are and what you're doing, even though they can't uniquely do what you're doing. And they can help you deal with the pressures and problems, because they may have skills and other abilities that are missing from your side of it, and vice versa. So collectively, you can better deal with the circumstances and relieve some of the more negative forces that are occurring. And this is a real possibility with the Internet and other ways of communicating with people. We now have a source. You can open a web page, the spiritually perseverant people. Please, here they are. You know, of course, a lot of people won't know what that is, but you may have to explain it a little bit. But you will get some people. You see, it's not a bad idea to start something like this. Because even if it's a couple thousand, that's a huge number if they work to help each other serve as souls, even though they're doing very unique and individual things. Ah, sound good? Yeah. And that is a real, this is a real possibility today. 20, 30 years ago, no way. Couldn't do it because there wasn't a means. Oh, you could run an ad in a newspaper, but you'd have to run an ad in thousands of newspapers to reach the few that there are. They'd be all throughout the world, but with the Internet, you could do it just an hour to create a page, do all this stuff. So it's really possible to make this kind of change. This is a very exciting idea, by the way, and I hope it makes some sense. And, of course, you know, I could do it, as well as those I know could do it, but it's better that I teach it first and maybe let others do it, right? That's not to say I won't do it, but I'm saying that I would rather participate in someone else having it, doing it first, if that's what their inclination is. All right, so it is, that is a good way, I would say, of dealing with the dilemmas of tonight's show, but there's some other things that can be done as well. When it comes to becoming a spiritual person, one of the things that most spiritual people actually in the beginning make as a mistake is they try to convince their familiar in their life, whether they are family or friends or whoever, that what they're doing is okay. And part of their, we'll say, perseverance is stifled by seeking to be okay with those they consider important to themselves. This is not abnormal, but it doesn't serve being spiritual. What it does instead is it becomes, as I said towards the beginning of the show, a means of distraction and misuse of our abilities to serve. All right, so what do you do to change that particular problem? Well, one of the things that I would suggest is that you don't give people what they want ever. You give people only what they need as a soul, and only sometimes. The process of weeding out giving on a personal level is a very, we'll say, difficult one, because it's always a tit for a tat. It's always seeking to get something whenever you're giving something, and people don't recognize it. Well, I'm just helping my kids, or I'm just helping my friend, or I'm just helping the person down the block. But you're also seeking to get something that's hidden from you. The way to stop doing this is to find the hidden agenda. The hidden agenda may be just that, oh, well, they'll pay more attention to me, or they'll listen to me, or they'll help me do this or that. Or maybe they'll give me sex. Or maybe they'll show some affection. Or maybe they'll be there when I need a ride or do something else. Or maybe they won't think badly of me. All of those things are traps. They're traps based upon our own lack of self-development, higher self-development, and too much selfishness in us with a personality that is just over-controlling. If the personality gives up the need to control others, it's also giving up a large amount of its selfishness. And people stuck in this position largely are selfish. So if you want to get over this, one of the things you can do is you can say, I will not give to anyone anything unless it's for their soul and it will help them to become better giving themselves. Otherwise, I won't do it. I won't do it because they're going to like me more. I won't do it because they're going to feel good. I won't do it because they'll think I love them. I won't do it because it'll increase their life expectancy. I won't do it because it will take them out of pain. I won't do it because it will make them happy and joyful. I won't do it because of any reason other than to help them to be a better server to others. If they're not going to serve better, I'm not going to do anything for them. Now, the willpower necessary to do this is great, because the personality's strength is in trying to get us to do what it wants to feel good itself, not service of its soul. We have to break that chain through spiritual perseverance and say, you know what? I know I'm on to what I am. I'm selfish. I'm on to it. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to stop this. Can you do that? Well, maybe with all the other things that I've said so far in tonight's show, maybe you can. It's a tricky problem. In a book called the Bhagavad Gita, which is actually a section of a bunch of books from India, it's a book about a battle that's taking place, and it's kind of metaphoric. This Arjuna guy who wants to kind of be the good guy is out in the battlefield supposedly going to fight his friends, his relatives, lovers, whatever. And he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to fight them because he wants them to be his friends and everything else. But they're evil. They want to take him over. They want him to be as dark and selfish as they are. Sound familiar? He's having a problem with spiritual perseverance. So he says, geez, I can't go any further. He's right in the middle. He's halfway to the other side to fight these folks. He's riding in a chariot. His chariot driver happens to be one of the greatest of all masters, Krishna. And Krishna doesn't let him know that he's a great master. Krishna realizes that he doesn't understand the greatness of who he is because Arjuna is not spiritually persevering. And he can't see him, okay? So Krishna says, okay, if you don't get up and fight, because Arjuna says, stop the chariot. So Krishna stops. He throws down his bow. He takes his arrows off and says, you know what? I'm not going to do this because those are my friends, they're my family, there are other peoples over there. And some of them I don't even know, but I don't want to kill them. Why should I want to kill them? And Krishna says, but you got an army behind you. And whatever you do is what they're going to do. If you throw down your weapons, they will throw down their weapons. And they'll all be subjugated by the darkness and evil of those folks that you think are so wonderful over there. Do you want to make all the people that are following you as selfish as you are at this moment and as the great number of people are on the other side over there? Krishna says, and Arjuna says, oh, well, I don't want to do that, but how am I to get out of this? And Krishna says, you've got to be your soul. You need to be your soul. Sound familiar? And Arjuna says, how can I be my soul when I can't spiritually persevere? Because I don't want to fight them. And Krishna says, but you're really fighting the fears in yourself. You're fighting the fear of who and what you are and what is lacking in you. You are not being your soul. You're being just like they are until you identify with who they are, and you won't fight them. And then Arjuna says, well, how am I to get out of this? Tell me who you really are, and maybe I will follow you. And Krishna says, well, if you really know who I am, you're going to find out that I'm the right arm of God. And that right arm of God is pressing on you right now. It's crushing you because of your own inadequacies. But if you want to see those inadequacies, I'll show them to you for a few seconds. It's the most you can handle. Arjuna says, okay, I'll do that. Sounds cool. Do it. And all of a sudden, Krishna turns into the most monstrous being that Arjuna can ever imagine, with the most amount of power he's ever even conceived of. He becomes frightened to the bone. He is shaking. He says, oh my, I had no idea who you are. And I had no idea who God is. God is the force that is leading me into this battle. You are too. Now I see. I must be my soul. But how do I know my soul? Krishna says, you'll know a soul first by its humility, which you're starting to develop a little of. And Arjuna says, it's a terrible, terrible thing. I don't want to fight, but I know I must. I don't want to be a soul, but that's the only way out. And I have to spiritually persevere, but I'm too afraid. And I'm even more afraid when I see what really God is. God is a being who makes me responsible for me and gives me the right to choose not to be, but at the same time pay the consequences. Well, it's our whole story for tonight, isn't it? It's the whole, this story is really the story of what someone who is in the problems we talked about tonight. And in Arjuna's case, I don't want to deflate you. you don't know this because you have to read the next page of the next chapter, which is in the next book, actually. So it's the end of the Bhagavad Gita, and he's stuck in this dilemma, and you don't know how he resolves it, but actually what he does do is he refuses to fight in that lifetime. And then the other side comes out to battle him, even though he doesn't want to, because they misread all of his motives, of course. And they kill him anyway. And when he goes to the astral world, Krishna visits him there. And Krishna says, well, your next life you'll probably do better. It's too bad in this one that you weren't able to spiritually persevere. And Arjuna says, but how will I do better in my next life? Because he's terribly remorseful, realizing he just totally screwed up. And how will I do any better? And Krishna says, well, here, the astral world, you will learn to love better. And in the next dimension, you will learn to think better. And when you come back again as a different person, that person will be a little more spiritually perseverant. That person will have a greater amount of what is needed to overcome these problems that are inherent in being human. And that person will love God more and not fear God so much. Therefore, you'll love me more because I'll still be your teacher. And Arjuna says, but if you're going to still be my teacher, how could you even want to be around me? I'm just a total screw-up. And Krishna says to Arjuna, but you're a soul, a great soul. I've known this soul for a long, long time. And it's a wonderful soul. It's just that this particular person has too much selfishness in it compared to its ability to be its soul. And it failed for just a few minutes in a critical circumstance. But I'll still be there for you. I'm not leaving you alone here. And I'll be there for you in the lower middle world. And I'll be there as your teacher. in your next life. Because even though you didn't succeed, you didn't reject God, you didn't reject me. If you had, then I wouldn't be available. But you didn't, and so I'll be there to help. That's the next book that most people don't know about. All right, so what is that story telling us? That story tells us that the most amazing thing about spiritual perseverance is that each lifetime you get another crack at it, and you can get a lot better at it. So even if you were to fail, as Arjuna did, you can succeed somewhere, either in this future, the future of this lifetime, in the astral or lower mental worlds, or it will as a new personality that you will help to create as a soul, and eventually will get to know your soul again in a more complete and fulfilling way while you spiritually serve other souls and do so from the angle of being a soul. Arjuna was able, once he got out of his remorse period in the astral world, to see that all those people that he had so much fondness for had even more, far more personality problems and conflicts in them. After all, they killed him. And he also did not do them any good by refusing to fight. Rather, he did the worst thing he could. He showed everybody else that it's good not to persevere spiritually and to succeed to fear and darkness and evil. And that was a terrible thing that he had to learn and understand. And I guarantee in his next lifetime he did much better with that. But you see, we each are on the battlefield. It's a metaphor for our life. And all the people out there that we're fighting are the people that we have to serve, at least at some point level of service, as souls, until they show that we can't be of service to them, and we go on to the ones we can. So this is the way you do battle. And you don't do battle by giving up, by becoming them, by letting them destroy you. None of those are answers. They are all ways of failing. And the answers are from tonight's show in general. I hope this has made a difference, because this is one of the problems that many people who are calling themselves or trying to be spiritual disciples have. This is where the crux of their issues come into play. It's why they say, oh, well, I tried that and couldn't do it. Really? Could you not do it, or did you make a decision? As Arjuna made the decision to not fight. And fighting means perseverance, by the way. As a matter of fact, the word is actually that religion, there is a crossover between the word fight and persevere. You know, they're actually mean similar things. Okay, so of course, in our language, fighting would have a more direct, forceful kind of thing than persevere. All right, so when we consider tonight's show, we can say that the summation of it is that if we're going to be spiritual in our perseverance, we're going to lead a very different kind of life. That life is not going to be like anyone else's. It's going to make us much more individual and unique. At the same time, we need to balance that life with being more of our soul, because otherwise we will destroy ourselves or others will come in and destroy us. Being our soul allows us to see who they really are and not be fooled by it, so that we give up our spiritual perseverance, as Arjuna did, or not be able to handle or deal with the types of forces that they're going to put up against us, which will be somewhat severe in some circumstances, and even trying to actually kill us in some circumstances. So we have a need to balance these two, and we have the ability to do so through spiritual discipline, through the teachings of people like myself and others as well, and reading and by others of materials that we've written and talked about, but also by getting assistance, possibly, this is a new idea, from those in a similar position. Not on the unique level of the perseverance, but on the shared level of soul insight, being able to work together, seeing that all these folks, or most of them, are souls. Now remember, there's a few people who are evil through and through. They don't have a soul. That's a little different. Those folks you deal with a little differently. Don't have time to go into any specifics about that, but I've dealt with that subject on other shows, and you can listen to those other shows to gain some better understanding of how to deal with them in a more, we'll call it, unique way. And I don't think for most of the time that is the serious concern, but some people it is. And so if it is, and also you can call me. And for sure, if you've got that problem, you should call me. Okay, so if we're going to sum it up, then we can say that the bottom line is to attempt to balance out these two sides of spirit, which is the first and second parts of God's mind, and to bring them as close together within ourselves in as focused a way so that we reach some levels of, we'll call it, controlled intuition, with as many levels of uncontrolled also, if that's the best we can do in some places or some parts of our existence, and bring that into full focus so that our controlled intuition gives us a jump up on all of the dark parts of people and the problems that we're going to have with them. And then if we're really, really, really focused on our spiritual perseverance, we may reach a point of being omnipotent. Not in every way in all things in life. Omnipotent in the ways that bring large numbers of people into becoming more their soul within short periods of time, which is just a matter of years. And I gave two examples of that, but there's a lot more. So that is how and where we can use our spiritual perseverance to be God's right arm. And it is the true expression of this that I think tonight's show could be a special kind of niche for some people. I don't think the majority of people are going to say, whoa, that was the greatest show I ever heard. But a few people are going to say, that's the show I needed to hear, and I needed to know more about this in order to achieve what I'm looking to do in this particular lifetime. Well, we definitely are out of time. Yes, there's a few things I didn't cover, I know. But the point is, I've covered enough so that you've got real good ideas of what to do and how to do spiritual perseverance. And I hope this has really been as meaningful for you as it has been for me, because I love teaching this stuff. Until next week, this has been Niles